Chapter 18. The Robin Wing Conclave. Robin Wing Castle was a grand old place, built on a high promontory overlooking the magnificent temple and tidy village below, about half a day's ride north from Rigdus Riverport. It was built in the old Sansaran style, with one huge, round, crenellated keep 80 feet high, surrounded by a 30-foot curtain wall, even facing the cliffside. The wall was punctuated every 50 feet by a 60-foot-high narrow tower of stone, each a multi-levelled platform for an abundance of missilery and artillery. The three-tiered switchback up the steep slope was guarded by a succession of gate towers and fortifications designed to slow the advance of besiegers. Not an impossible castle to take, but not an easy one either. During the early days of the settlement of the Castali Riverlands, Robin Wing had been a baronial march castle, responsible for defending the frontier with Alshar. That had been centuries ago, before the border between the two realms had shifted 600 miles west, and larger, more impressive fortresses were employed. For 100 years it had enjoyed a quiet life as a major baronial fief, and then a secondary fief, when the politics demanded a grander castle be built in a more strategic location. Without a powerful political or military reason to exist, however, it was difficult to justify the expense of so large a fort. Robin Wing had eventually been sold to pay some baron's debts. After changing hands a few times, it had been confiscated by the coronet for unpaid taxes. There hadn't been a sitting lord there for longer than Sevendor had gone without. The town below had prospered, despite the lack of a feudal overlord. The burghers had quietly bribed their way into a reduced obligation to the lord of the domain and increased the revenues from trade and from the pilgrims making their way to the Temple of Paris, imperial goddess of earthly wisdom. The temple, more than the castle, was responsible for Robin Wing Town's prosperity. The temple dated from a shrine built by imperial rangers who used the spot as a refuge. The miraculous properties of the local herbs and fungi lured a trio of priestesses of Paris hither 50 years before the conquest, where they ministered to the rangers and, later, a full legion of imperial soldiers. After the conquest, when the land was settled by Narasi, the priestesses did what they could to save imperial culture. It became a repository for copies of records from eastern temples, in perfectly justified fear that my superstitious ancestors would burn them. By the time the Castali lords came up the river to the place, there was an entire colony of priestesses and lay scholars inhabiting the outpost. The dukes wisely recognized the importance of the place and put it under the protection of a lord, and the fief grew up from there, or so said the bargemen on our short journey downriver. Ordinarily it takes 2 to 3 days to go downstream from Sendaria to Rigdus, after you go overland for half a day. But when you have a couple of bored high magi on board, things move a lot more quickly. I taught Rondal the spell to reduce the friction between the hull and the water, while Ser Festeran and Bannermore listened with great interest, and then we propelled the barge forward with a conjured water elemental. Between the two spells, we more than doubled our speed, much to the terror and delight of the captain. We made the trip in a day, but more than enough time for us to learn about Robin Wing Castle. We were met at the docks by a full-fledged honor guard, 20 men-at-arms bearing the Robin Wing badge, and a group of functionaries led by a tall young man of perhaps 25. He bore an apprentice's cap, the Robin Wing tabard, and a yellow sash bordered in red. He proved to be Sire Forandal's senior apprentice, Dijo. With great deference, probably too great, he welcomed me to Robin Wing and insisted that his men see our baggage to our quarters in the castle. Then he produced a bottle of a very nice red wine and toasted our arrival, and I couldn't be rude and refuse. By the time we got to the castle, I had a nice rosy glow. Sire Forandal was settling into the role of mage lord nicely. Indeed, he'd been bred for the task. The neatly ordered servants swirled about the room with quiet efficiency, seeing to the needs of the arriving guests. It put my rude hospitality in Sevendor to shame. In comparison, I suddenly felt like I was lord of a drafty ruin, despite the incredible work we'd done to Sevendor. Robin Wing was just larger, better appointed, and well run. But I do confess a few moments of castle envy after I arrived. Further, Sir Farrandall was quite the gracious host. Rundall and I had each been given private quarters in the cliffside section of the keep, while our men were quartered in one of the towers. Bannermore was assigned a section in the Great Hall. I almost objected to that, but he insisted.
"That's a better bed than I'm used to, believe me," he murmured to me, after putting a hand on my shoulder. "And better for other things, too."
"What kind of things? A man at the fire late at night is likely to hear things a man deep in council at the top of the tower does not," he pointed out. "I thought you might like an ear where you lacked one." "I would," I agreed, impressed by the man's foresight. He was right. I needed to know what was going on outside of the sphere of magi I would be conferring with. I felt sneaky, using him as a spy, but I knew I needed to get used to the idea. I wasn't going to pass up the help if it was so freely offered. Bannermore may not have an abundance of talent, but he's shrewd. Rundall was treated like a night mage himself when he arrived, and was whisked away to his own room nearby to refresh himself. My quarters were stately, with an elegant canopied bed I vowed to find a way to steal, and a beautiful old tapestry along the interior wall. The balcony outside had fruit trees and flowering vines around a lovely little stone table, where a bowl of fruit and a ewer of wine had been placed. A liveried castellan was only a bell ring away, ready to bring me whatever I wished. Life as a mage lord was good. After I refreshed myself and checked in with Penny, who was on her way in her private barge with an extensive retinue, including her father, several senior members of the Order of the Secret Tower, her cousin Planus, and a large baggage train, the castellan politely informed me that Mage Lord Farrandall was receiving guests in the rooftop garden, if I felt so inclined. I did. I barely knew the man. He was a friend and colleague of Talaman, who was also en route. I knew he had fought hard and well at Timberwatch, and had richly deserved his reward. There was a lot of goblin blood on his hands. It would be discourteous not to share a drink with my host. I'd spent only a few hours with him, and he seemed like a fine fellow, on short acquaintance. I put on my lordly raiment and let the castellan lead me to a pleasant little garden that covered a third of the roof of the keep. It wasn't entirely ornamental. The fruit and nut trees were in flower, and I counted dozens of medicinal herbs in pots and small garden plots arrayed around the space, and a small pool, perhaps the top of a cistern, reflected the torchlight, flickering in the breeze. Sire Farrandall was sitting under a red canvas canopy in the midst of the garden, a few servants discreetly out of earshot, with a young woman playing a harp nearby. He was a little intimidating in his presentation. I was a spellmonger come war mage who had been knighted and ennobled. Farrandall was a mage lord from his crown to his heel. He looked the part, wise, insightful, powerful, confident, with just enough egotistical arrogance to discourage casual buffoonery in his presence. The lordly fellow was speaking with two old friends, Wenick, mage lord of the Pearwoods, and Sir Taran, the brilliant young war mage and thaumaturge who had been so instrumental in the Battle of the Timberwatch. Both seemed in excellent health, and from their dress they were quite prosperous. Wenick seemed to be fleshing out under his dark green robes, which complemented the several golden rings he wore. Sir Taran, by contrast, had eschewed finery, but had not abandoned quality. He wore a dashing mantle of black, upon which he'd had the Ilnasi rune associated with the order embroidered tastefully on the breast. Under that, he wore a dark grey woolen doublet of fine greyed wool, well-tailored and tastefully adorned with tiny silver stars at the collar and wrists. In place of hose, he wore black riding leathers and tall cavalry boots. His mage blade leaned against his chair, along with an intriguing-looking new staff. "Gentlemen," I said, not waiting to be announced. All three started to rise, but I motioned them to sit. "Just looking for a drink before bed and perhaps a quiet smoke, and to thank my gracious host for the use of his magnificent fortress." "Then you found all three," Farrandall said, continuing to stand. "Come, mage lord." "Oh, we're all mage lords here. No need to stand on ceremony," I dismissed. "And old comrades as well. Call me Minolin, or just Min, after a few drinks."
"As you wish," he agreed, smiling. "Congratulations on the birth of your son. Come,
A drink to his health is in order. Well, I couldn't really say no to that, could I? In fact, I couldn't say no to the next several drinks as we toasted various worthy things. Nor could I say no when Wenwick brought forth a flask of his vassal's fresh pear brandy, newly drawn from the still and raw as a drunken whore on your tongue. By moonrise the torches had been replaced. We didn't need them, but the place seemed warmer and cozier with them than by magelight. Forondal commanded the evening meal to be brought up to us, trenchers with whole roasted pullets, cheese and greens, along with sufficient quantity of ale to wash it down. He proved an excellent host, as gracious as a Gilmoran. The young harpist was replaced by a guitarist, accompanied by a tambour, while another young lady came up to dance for us while we dined. "One of my wards," Forondal admitted. "I have her for another year, and then I have to marry her off. She came with the castle. I have four wards, actually, but she's by far the most comely." "One could have worse responsibilities," Wenwick nodded, unable to keep his eyes off the lass. "So how fares the Pearwoods?" I asked Wenwick. The man gave the question some drunken consideration, and then sighed and farted at the same time. "Well enough," he said deliberately. "Well enough. The clans all look to me now for all the good it does. Calling myself lord seems unfair. More of a wet nurse breaking up fights between brats in the yard. But the harvest was good. The barley is thick, and the losses from the war lighter than they could have been. And with the army at Timberwatch, there's a ready market for our grain." "How about you, Forondal?" I asked politely. "Any trouble with your vassals?" "My vassals?" he asked thoughtfully. "No, actually, or far less than I'd thought there'd be. I have three knights enfeoffed to me. Small fiefs, but prosperous. In the years that Robin Wing was under the coronet, though, the burghers in town have been loaning money to the peasants and buying up fields throughout the domain. They own half of the land in my domain, for doin's sake, and have liens on the other half. The knights are hoping I can control the burghers." "Can you?" asked Wenwick, curiously. "I think I've hit on a way," he confided. "You know the terms concerning service to the coronet?" "I'd negotiated that myself. 2 months of military service for a mage land, compared to one of any other fiefdom. The additional month was intended as a check on the relative power of a mage lord, compared to a regular lord. After all, military service was the whole point of the feudal relationship, that and taxation. Many lords found it difficult to fulfill even 1 month's service a year. The idea of providing 2 without support was appalling. Well, I've decided to pass on that burden to the town. Their charter specifies that the obligation to my overlord is to be fulfilled by soldiers recruited from the town. It does not specify the duration of the obligation, merely that the town shall provide the difference between the levy of the vassal knight's household obligations and the obligations of the domain. And since my vassals are not required to fulfill my additional military obligation, the town must make up their difference." "So you plan on keeping the burghers in check by arming them?" Taran asked, confused. "No, no," Forondal shook his head. "The town can elect to pay a scutage fee, instead of providing a soldier, enough silver to pay for a mercenary for the duration. My steward calculates that the additional revenue raised will allow me to start buying out the loans of the peasants and yeomen, and getting control of my land again." "What about the actual levies?" Taran inquired. "If you spend all of your money on land..." "Oh, I have a sufficiency," he smirked, as he held his cup out for more wine. "I brought back a fair amount of loot from Faris, and I've managed to do 1 or 2 little jobs. I'll have no problem funding the soldiers when the time comes. But if I can keep the burghers out of the manors and in the town where they belong, then they won't have the leverage over my knights to keep them at home if I need them. Say, to put down burgher riots." "I'll have to keep that in mind," Wenwick agreed with a grunt, "although in the Pear Woods, money in general is hard to come by. I get paid my tribute in spirits, or pears, or ham, usually. Different organization," he said, shaking his head. "What about your new land, Minilin?" asked Forondal. "So I told them the tale of Sevendor and its neighbors, how poor the land was, yet how much promise was there. thanks to the dedicated Bovali and Master Omeg. I finished by relaying my plans for the magic fair. Wenik was enthusiastic, because the Pearwoods grew a wide variety of herbs used in magic, and Taran, because he was a thaumaturge who often had to hunt for weeks or months to find a particular component to a spell. That got us on to the subject of the meeting itself, and that led to a broader discussion of the role of magic in the New Kingdom, and our own roles within magic. The talk went long into the evening, until I finally couldn't keep my eyes open, and then I was led back to my quarters to that incredible bed, where I passed out until noon the next day. The next 3 days saw a steady arrival of high magi, sometimes by themselves or in pairs, but mostly in clumps. First to arrive, just after dawn, was the Rhaemeran contingent, led by Penny's father and her cousin Planus, and included 2 wains loaded with scrolls and books long kept hidden from the censorate. I immediately grabbed Penny and we began working non-stop on preparing for the conference. But that didn't stop the incoming magi. Mage Lord Astarol and the War Magi from Tudri, including the mage lands around the Penumbra, arrived the day after that. Many of them were redeploying towards the Gilmoran baronies to counter the goblin offensive there, immediately after the conference. Azar, in particular, was pleased to be leading 200 heavy cavalry south from his barony of Megalin. There were several war magi, unaugmented by witchstones, who were included in his unit. He had been taking on recruits from all over the 5 duchies, and his cadre of goblin fighting knights and squires had labored ceaselessly during the winter to keep the hordes at bay. It was by far the largest party. Not only were Astarol and Azar present, but so were Carmella, Kermor, Master Comaran, Rostallo, Raylan, Landric, and Ben Donnell. Azar himself looked like some barbaric prince, his heavy blackened plate armor and oversized mage blade adorned with blue feathers and gold rivets. He stopped the moment he saw me, dismounted, and gathered me into a hug that threatened to break my ribs. "Spellmonger," he boomed. "Well met. When shall we see you in the field again?" "When the paperwork is finished," I sighed. The big mage made a face, a sneer of contempt. "There's enough glory to go around, I suppose," he finally said, "and I guess it's important that someone pays the men. But damn it, Min, we had fun this winter. We missed you." Astarol was less enthusiastic, but more in control. He promised a full report at council, but in the few moments we had to exchange greetings, I learned that Tudri had but 15,000 souls in it, half of its former population, and 10,000 of those were garrison soldiers. Many thousands of others were refugees, still fleeing the Penumbra and the onslaught. "The walls are much stronger now," he assured me. "Carmella has been all over them, and she's got them as tight as magically possible. The surrounding country is filled with redoubts and hidden defences. The refugees fell to a trickle, but the place is just an army town now. The men from the Timberwatch encampment spent a good amount of coin on leave in Tudri over the winter, as they were gradually redeployed. But it isn't the same old Tudri. We're even thinking of renaming it." I remembered the old Tudri. I wouldn't miss it. I thanked him for his service and then directed him to Penny's chamber, where she was unpacking and preparing for the evening's reception. Master Dunsellan arrived with a small party later that day, and then Master Thinraddle appeared near midnight. Mavone got there the next morning with General Hartarian, escorted by a column of loyal censors who had traded their checkered cloaks for plain green ones. With them was another 2 wagons of important items taken from the censorate citadel in Wenshaw, mostly confiscated magical texts and illegal artifacts thought important to the war effort. Master Ikarad of Vendemir arrived the next morning, with Lance of Boon on his heels, followed by the highly flamboyant Sarakim of Merwin, who had been doing a quick job in the Riverlands before joining us. "Is that everyone?" I asked Pentandra. The third morning we were at Robinwing. "Tyndall is in Sevendor," she counted off. "Easily wasn't invited, with good reason, and Telemann should be arriving from the southern front any time now. Oh, and Roloff hasn't been heard from at all." Roloff had been one of the original war magi Penny recruited to lift the siege of Bovol. Like his fellows, he'd been granted a stone, and had fought valiantly through the entire siege, even to face the dead god. But since our escape, no one had seen Roloff, at all. He'd stayed with us for a week or so, as we made our way toward civilization, and then, when the group started to splinter, he had quietly slipped away. No one had any idea where he was. He hadn't gotten a chance to employ Penny's communication spell, and we hadn't spared the time to find him in the other world. But I figured he'd turn up sooner or later. And as it was, we had most of the high magi in the world under one roof. "It will have to do," I sighed. "Go ahead and ask the senior fellows to meet with me and our host on the roof tonight for supper for a brief planning meeting. We have a lot to discuss." And we did. I'll spare you the hours and hours of pointless discussion, debate, and bloviating opinion that occurred that night. Most of what was said was meaningless, pointless, or just plain dumb. It took a great deal of work to keep everyone on topic, working in the same direction, and I honestly credit Penny for most of that. She and her little coven of clerks kept the discussion on the agenda we'd agreed on, and didn't let anyone take over for their own purposes. As for my part, I mostly sat back and listened, playing with my witch sphere, as the other leaders of our order made suggestions and shot them down. The upshot of the first evening's council was purely organizational. After much discussion, it was decided that all of the High Magi in the duchies formed the College of High Magi, of which I was named the regent. The non-witchstone-bearing magi who had gotten trained, accepted, and credentialed by the old system were placed under the College of Adepts for organizational purposes, and one of Master Dunsellan's recently graduated apprentices, Master Mael, was appointed its regent for the moment. He had a strong reputation for administration, stronger than his reputation for magic, which made him an ideal candidate. The foot wizards, undocumented hedge witches, and all such practitioners of folk magic, wild magic, talented sports, and religious magic were placed under the College of Wizards. We postponed naming anyone to that regency just yet. We still didn't know what the hell we were going to do with them. But by midnight we had three colleges, neatly separating the administration of magic into high, medium, and low realms. It seems a simple task, in retrospect, but it took 6 hours of heated debate just to get that far. And that was with us all more or less in agreement at the beginning. The next day, we all moved to the better space within the Temple of Paris, where the priestesses had granted us the largest chamber not currently being used for worship to meet within. Dozens of chairs had been brought in to seat everyone, and I took charge of the meeting just long enough to make an impressive speech about how we were shaping the world for our descendants and defiantly struggling against both the dead god and the censorate, and a bunch of other stuff Penny insisted was important. Then I turned the meeting over to her, and we began in earnest. For 3 days straight, we listened to more debate and suggestion about the specifics of how we would reconstitute the magical body of the land. Masters Dunsellan and Thinraddle were invaluable in this part, as each of them had extensive experience with administrating magic and were able to offer their insights. And after 3 days, we had come up with something resembling a plan. The regional court magi would continue to administer the training and testing and certification of adepts, as we were calling them now. They would also be in charge of reporting any misuse of magic in ways that our profession frowned upon, selling half-powered spells, reneging on commissions, claiming powers you didn't have, and outright fraud. To handle those cases, we created a special office within the College of High Magi, Master of Enforcement. We selected, by unanimous acclamation, because it was close to dinner and we were tired, Sire Landric for this job, as his experience in the censorate and his unquestioned loyalty to our cause made him an ideal candidate. He was tasked with developing a way to actually enforce the laws we made by recruiting deputies who would answer to the Collegium of the Arcane Orders, as the three bodies were collectively called, and promised a budget to hire men and magi to do it. Then we turned our attention back to the war, and spent the next day listening to reports from war magi who had spied and scried on the enemy all winter long. The overview was given by Sir Telamon, who had finally gotten in from the southern front on a nearly dead horse. The news was not good. There are nearly 100,000 goblins massed in the southern Alshari wilderlands, he said in calm tones as he effortlessly conjured a mage map to demonstrate. They are preparing to march, likely as soon as the weather breaks. There are already advanced parties of raiders invading the northern Gilmoran baronies. For the most part, they are only attacking villages and hamlets or small manors, and leaving castles alone. Their raiding seems designed to push as many men into their lords' castles and fortresses as possible, Taran added, and they are going after specific things, foodstuffs mostly, and slaves when they can capture them. They seem to be stockpiling supplies, he reasoned. They have some depots where they're bringing the gathered loot and captured slaves along the Great Cotton Road, but they're too well defended to break, and the local lords are more concerned with protecting their folk.
So what are we doing about protecting their folk? Asked Pentandra.
5 towns and castles in Ark, from southwest to northeast, are being heavily garrisoned in preparation. We've sent as many mercenaries and volunteers from the south to strengthen them, as well as war magi when we could. Each is expected to be able to repel, or at least screen, any major advance. In the meantime, each will be chasing the Gavani raiders that haunt their lands, he explained.
How many troops?
At least 4,000 or 5,000, he answered with a nod. More than enough to handle a single legion. The Gavani military organization was odd compared to ours. Their ancient warrior societies had transformed into military units of roughly 2,000. We called them legions, after the imperial unit structure. With their ghastly heraldry and ferocious brutality, it seemed an apt description. But not enough to defend against tens of thousands of Gavani shock troops, Terleman added, tight-lipped. As things stand, we have an army of 20,000, mostly peasant levies and local knights, at the great baronial castle of White Tree, here in northern Gilmora, he said, and the region indicated itself on the mage map. That's the largest force in the area. If the whole Gavani column attacked them in open battle, they'll be wiped out. Unless they can be allured into a siege. That's unlikely, but it's a possibility. Over here in Tantanel City, we have 8,000 mercenaries, and another 2,000 peasant levies, maybe 1,000 knights and sergeants. The fortress of Saram has 7,000 good-quality infantries and 1,000 lances. And here at Graa, we have another 5,000 local knights, and the town levies from the surrounding cities. At Nyon, we have another 4,000. That's it. None of them are close enough to the other to be able to protect their flanks or even send ready reinforcements, not within days. Yet if we move any of the forces to give ourselves a better aspect, then we expose them to attack. Yet 40,000 men against 100,000 goblins seems a fair defense, Sarakim said sagely. He loved doing that, I noticed, agreeing to the obvious after someone else's eloquent summation, in an effort to make him look smarter than he was. As annoying idiosyncrasies go, it wasn't too bad. Not as bad as, say, having your witch stone made into an earring, which the Wenchari war mage had also done. Observant, Terleman said sourly, but it doesn't help solve the strategic situation. Our best bet is to wait to see which marching route they take. If it's southerly, then we can use White Tree to block them, while Graar and Tantanel move up on them from their flanks. If it's straight easterly, then we'll be able to use Graar to block them for maybe 5 whole minutes, and then they start chewing through the central riverlands.
What about Darkfaller? Someone asked.
Darkfaller is problematic, Terleman admitted. The Count of Darkfaller was a kinsman of the Alshari ducal house, and he's unwilling to send his men or let us use his castle to defend from, regardless of the nature of the threat. Indeed, he's had 2 messengers requesting his aid hung. His family has a history backing the Alshari claim to Gilmora, and that's giving him a legacy of rebellion to build upon.
If not Darkfaller, I asked, then where can you defend in central Gilmora?
There are a few castles of note between there and Barrow Bell, but that's the heart of cotton country. Once they get inside the Gilmoran Riverlands, there just isn't a lot left to stop them. Most manors there are undefended from serious attack, and proper castles a few. But there are contingencies for retreating and setting up new lines of defense further south, if the Horde makes its way toward Barrowbell. They have already filled the ether with their foul spells of despair, Taran reported. They are using the goblin stones that have long lain dormant in the Riverlands, and building new ones where they have need. Every miserable tear of suffering from their murder mills is flung into the dreams of all within their sway. That wins them half of their battle when their raiders come in the night. Their shamans roam everywhere with troops of these new eunuchs and trolls, engaged in all sorts of mischief, mostly pillaging manors for food, but also taking slaves for torture and food. The dead god's minions have not been unopposed, Azar boasted, as he rose and took a pouch from within his doublet. The Megalini knights and I have had a prosperous winter in the penumbra. 117 of our men dead, but near 1,000 dead Gavani and 9 witch stones to show for it, he said triumphantly, as he tossed me the pouch. I caught it and could instantly feel the seething power within the soft leather. I nodded to him in thanks. I've 5 myself from the southern front, admitted Talaman, and there are a few others among us who have taken stones that need to be cleansed and distributed. But even if we should all depart on the morrow for Gilmora, we would not be sufficient to keep the Horde at bay once they arrive in the Riverlands. In the Timberwatch they were forced to battle by geography. In the open country of the Riverlands, he shrugged grimly. They can go anywhere. So what do we do? Asked someone. Lance of Boon, I saw, smoking a cheap clay pipe in the back, his tall, lanky frame laying over his chair like a blanket that had been thrown there. Let the Riverlands fall? Let Gilmora fall? My new estate is just east of there. Of course not, I said, interrupting Talaman ungraciously. But this was important. We yield no acre freely or without purpose. The Riverlands are some of the richest domains in the duchies, home to 1 million people at least. To the dead god, those are 1 million sacrificial victims he can expand his realm with, and 1 million head of cattle with which to feed his soldiery when he has taken their lives. But abandon the Gilmoran baronies? No. We will defend them, and defend them vigorously. We only have to figure out how. We need more war magi, Talaman said matter-of-factly, as many as we can field. Knights magi and regular war magi, everyone. And we need more fighting men in general. But even with all of that, well, have you ever seen how a couple of trolls deal with a siege at a simple mott and bailey castle, or a fortified manor house? They step over the moat, they rip off the gate, and then they start tearing the stones out of the wall, or they start tearing apart the palisade, and while they're doing that, 500 goblins pour in behind them. We're losing castles all over the upper Riverlands that way. Anything smaller than a baronial castle is at risk, and if the people cannot take refuge with their lords, they flee. If they are not caught immediately, they roam the countryside in fear, their desperation and terror making them almost as bad as the Gavani. If they make it to a manor that will take them in, they have nothing. If they are caught, then they get sent to the Cotton Road, and north, into the penumbra. So we need magi, we need men, we need an army, and we need someone to lead it. But even if we get all of that, we're still looking at a protracted war over the Fertile Belt. Talaman folded his arms, matter-of-factly. Well, we have knights magi, I conceded. We have mage lords and war magi, and now it looks like we'll have over 12 more before long. But we lack organization, and a good intelligence and command structure. We lack good supply lines. Terl, you've done a remarkable job with almost nothing, but we need a more permanent solution, an institutional solution. What can we do about that? It was a simple question. 9 hours later, as the sun was coming up, we had the beginnings of an answer. We established the orders of Hesia and Horka, named for 2 of our fallen comrades. I still had Hesia's Witchstone. I was loath to give it away, for some reason. But her valiant example in the defense of Timberwatch, and of course Horka's ambitious, single-handed, and ultimately fatal battle with a dragon on the battlefield, had inspired all of us, and we chose to honor them thus. The Hesian Order was dedicated to defensive magics,
supply, ordnance, intelligence, and support in the war. As a sigil, they took a black castle tower on a red field surmounted by 5 white stars. The Horkan Order was the combat arm, the order of knights magi who would range the Penumbra lands and fight Shiro's madness wherever they found it. They took as their sigil the Ilnarsi death rune we'd been using since Boval, surrounded by 5 black stars. Much to my consternation, I was made titular head of both orders, Lord Commander of the Order of Horka and Master Adept for the Order of Hesia. I think I could feel both of them smirking at me from the afterlife. I immediately made Telamon Knight Commander, the executive head, which I think irritated Azar. But if Azar would follow anyone, it would be Telamon, and then made Azar Commander of the North, and charged him with defending the northern side of the Penumbra, made Astaroth Commander of the East, and made Kermor Commander of the South. I charged each of them with establishing a commandery, building a garrison, and provisioning their fortifications in perpetuity. The way things were going, that could mean 6 months, but I'm a wineskin half-full kind of guy. For the Hessian Order, I named Carmella the Mistress of Works, charging her with the lasting defense of the realm, and tasked her to build a storehouse and supply chain. The next day, after a scant few hours' rest, we reconvened to handle other details. Specifically, we founded a new medical order of High Magi, the Order of Mandros, headed, of course, by the wily Master Ikarod, who had bribed me 300 ounces of gold to do so. We also established a new scholarly order, the Order of Takarin, named for a famous pre-conquest magical philosopher, which is different than thaumaturgy because, well, it just is, from Wenchar. I named Master Dunsalan to that honor, since he was anticipating a quiet life of research after he retired to his newly won family estate. He had the administrative skills to keep the educational system within the future kingdom running, and I charged him specifically with founding 6 new regional schools. That drew a lot of interest from the assembled. The scant number of proper academies had hampered our profession, forcing most to endure oppressive and inefficient apprenticeships. The cost of those schools was prohibitive to most magi. More schools meant more wizards. That's where I made another impassioned plea, this time on behalf of the foot wizards and other undocumented magi lurking in the lanes. Many could become perfectly fine spellmongers, or even specialists, if given proper training without charging them their patrimony to do it. And we would need them, even the ones whose powers were quirky. Apart from the evil lurking in the West, I explained, the fact is that magic could improve the lives of everyone in the duchies, if it was allowed to be used properly. These lesser magi must be brought out into the open, be allowed to practice their craft, even if they do not have the same credentials as imperially trained magi. Should they charge as much? Of course not. But for the types of peasant magic they're doing, they are hardly a commercial threat to our trade. There was a skeptical but tolerant reaction to that. But that was better than I expected. Animosity is the usual reaction to a foot wizard from a chartered mage when he thinks of them at all. After all, hadn't the Magi spent a fortune and devoted years of his life to learning a very difficult and exacting craft? And then some gaudily dressed master of cantrip shows up and claims the same powers and sometimes the same fees for his tricks. There was more discussion, but I think my speech and the general excitement carried the issue. If Mage Lord Minolan wanted to include the Uncharted in his new scheme, why not? To be fair, most did see the foot wizards as an annoyance more than colleagues, but there was also a fair amount of sympathy for them. After all, we all dreaded a visit from the censorate. For them, it was often a death sentence. After that debate, we had a late lunch out in the temple courtyard, provided by Sire Forandal. He seemed to be enjoying the role of host, moving from one knot of his fellows to the other, shaking hands, making small talk, and generally impressing on everyone just how noble and lordly he was. "He's one to watch," Penny said quietly, while we ate next to a bed of pop lilies. "Not in a bad way," she amended when my eyes narrowed. "He has leadership potential." "Are you picking out my successor already?" I asked, amused.
Yours? No, Min. You're in this for life. But mine? Perhaps.
Don't even think about it, I warned. If I'm in this for life, you are too.
Sure, whatever you say. But this whole organization thing is just beginning. If we keep expanding our reach, and we'll have to, then we're going to need good, competent leaders like him. Didn't we just create, like, 3 or 4 new orders?
Just the beginning,
she assured me, and we're only halfway through the day. I groaned. What next? Hasn't everything been decided yet?
Hardly, she said, matter-of-factly. In fact, the really hard stuff is still ahead of us. We're just getting our foundations laid. But you should feel gratified. This afternoon we're going to discuss distribution of witchstones and training, and then we're going to have a big reception, paid for by the Order of the Secret Tower.
Huh, that's not very secret, I pointed out.
Thanks to you, neither are they any more. But if you're thinking that this is a thinly veiled attempt to bribe their way into your good graces, you aren't wrong. They want a private meeting with you tonight, after the reception.
I suppose it was inevitable. And they are going to release all of those old spell books and texts you mentioned.
It should be just regular, normal business. Well, it'll be business. But just to prepare you, they want some things, and some assurances, and Planus wants a witchstone.
Everyone wants something, I sighed. All right, I'll meet them in their quarters after the party. A couple of drinks should put me in the perfect mood to deal with your father.
You know, that is just what Mother always says, she said thoughtfully.